Thank you for joining us today at Becker's Healthcare. Today is the third episode of our podcast series with Lean Toss. Here we talk about what's called No Operating Room Left Behind. And this podcast features Brian Dawson, who's the Senior Vice President of Perioperative Services with Common Spirit Health. It also features Sanjeev Agrawal, the President and Chief Operating Officer for Lean Toss. Today on this episode, Brian and Sanjeev, interviewed by Joe Pardavilla, we'll discuss predictive analytics and online tools and increased financial performance in the OR, as well as quality of patient care and surgeon satisfaction. Have a listen.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing great, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Brian. So Common Spirit Health is one of the largest health systems in the country. So for folks who are not familiar with it, can you tell us about it?
Yeah. Common Spirit is the combination of Dignity Health System and Catholic Health Initiative.
That's fantastic. So before I hand things over to Sanjeev, can you tell us how you ended up needing to sort of sign up and hook up with the folks over at Lean Toss?
So we had an initiative called Rock the Block, where we were looking to expand our surgical volume through identifying and unlocking unused surgical time. And it was all going to be manual, and we were trying to come up with ways to do it. And I was familiar with Lean Toss about 4 or 5 years ago here in Colorado at University of Colorado. And so I reached out to our leadership and said, I think I've got the perfect company to solve this initiative that we're looking at. And we established a relationship with Lean Toss, and it's been positive ever since then.
Well, what inspired that initiative, by the way? Was there something you weren't seeing that you weren't liking, that you felt the need to make some changes?
Well, yeah, you know, perioperative services, or our procedural areas, are really the engine that drives the collective train of healthcare, if you would. So we were looking to expand the number of surgical procedures that we were doing in our markets so that we could grow our business. And by identifying and unlocking unused time and making it available to surgeons, not only would we keep the surgeons at our facilities instead of going to our sister facilities looking for open time, we could also bring in new surgeons who weren't familiar with our organization because we now had time that they could use.
As you mentioned, we've been partnering with Dignity now for several years. I'm going to step back a little bit and get to know you a little bit in terms of your professional career, Brian. How did you get here?
I started off in the Navy as a staff nurse back in 1983. And I progressed to the operating room as a staff nurse in the OR in the early 80s. Went on from there to become an OR department head. I ran the Navy's surgical technology program in Bethesda, Maryland. Had an opportunity to serve as a perioperative nurse aboard a warship. And as my career progressed in the Navy, I was afforded an opportunity not only to run large operating rooms at some of our healthcare systems in the Navy, some of our teaching hospitals, I also had an opportunity to become a hospital CEO at the Naval Hospital in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and then a hospital CEO of the U.S. Naval Hospital in Okinawa, Japan. My last 2 years in the Navy, I served as the Navy Surgeon General's Chief of Staff and Executive Assistant. And when I retired, I started my civilian career as the Vice President of Perioperative Services in Salem, Oregon. I moved here to Colorado and worked as the Director of Perioperative Services for St. Anthony's Hospital, which is part of the Sentara Health System here in Denver. I started my own healthcare consulting company, did some teaching for ARN, their senior perioperative nurse executive course, and then I started doing consulting work. I worked for Sutter Healthcare in Sutter Solano in the Bay Area. I also did a contract with USC in Southern California, and Sanjeev, that's where you and I first met.
That's right.
That progressed into this opportunity with Dignity and then Common Spirit. And so I've been in and around, you know, healthcare since 1983 and in the OR for almost that whole time.
And you know, what's really awesome about that background is it's not just academic and community. You're one of the few people I personally know that's seen academic, community, and military. If you think about the kind of influence the government
yeah.
has on payers and providers in this country. So you started talking about why the OR is so important in the operations of a hospital. Maybe spend a little bit of time talking about the differences between, say, a CommonSpirit, which is one of the largest community-based health systems, versus academic medical centers like USC and others, or UC Health, and the military. Like, how would you highlight the major differences between how these places operate when it comes to the OR?
The operating room is pretty much the same at all of those facilities. You want it to run efficiently and effectively. And the goal is to do as many surgical procedures as the time frame gives you to accomplish. And so organizing that milieu, it's almost like a conductor of an orchestra, organizing all of the different surgical subspecialties, all of the different staff, the different departments that the operating room works with, to get patients in and out and to provide them with world-class care that's individualized, and to make sure that not only are we taking care of the patient's surgical needs, but we're taking care of the patient as a person and their family. Our goal is to bring in as much business as possible and do it with the best quality that we can provide.
You know, often in healthcare, we have this belief that when you've seen one hospital or one OR, you've seen one hospital or one OR, when in fact, what you said just resonates so much with me, because when you build an operating room and you spend a couple of $1 million, whether you're the Navy or you're an academic medical center or you are CommonSpirit, what you're hoping is that that capital you just spent will be used, like you said, most efficiently and effectively, which in business terms translates into patient access and lower cost, because at the end of the day, if we can see more patients, provide them world-class care at the lowest possible cost, we're doing well. Now, let's go back to the basics. You know, you mentioned rock the block and this idea of block time, and it's existed forever since the beginning of, since Adam and Eve, it seems, when we talk about block time.
True.
Why was it created? And it can be good and challenging all at once.
Like you said, back in the dark ages, I think block time was created to give a specific surgeon or group of surgeons access to the OR so they could plan their clinic schedule around those surgical procedures. So if a doctor's, you know, has office hours throughout the week, then he or she would know, okay, Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday is my day to go to the OR and operate. And so surgeons wanted to be able to coordinate their schedule, so hospitals gave them block time. Mm-hmm. Now that's a good thing, because I know that I've basically planned for that room for that day a full slate of surgeries. The thought is that I'll fill the operating room Monday through Friday with blocks, so I know exactly who's going to be there, what type of surgical procedure. I can have all the equipment and all the people there to do those surgical procedures. So that sounds great. I'd say 60% of the time it works really well. Here's where it doesn't work well. What if that surgeon can't fill his or her block and nobody else knows there's available time? And now that room sits idle. I have a room with the staff, nurse, tech, anesthesia, and now it's sitting empty. And so I'm no longer generating revenue. I'm now losing money. And so there's a lot of talk about productivity. And if the staff doesn't have things to do, you want to send them home and save dollars. But the best thing to do is to manage those blocks. Now, surgeons don't like to give up their block because that's my time. You promised me. So I want to keep it just in case I have a case that comes through the clinic door the day before surgery. And so that argument has been used for decades. The other argument that they've used is, we don't believe the data that you show us, because how did you calculate it?
That's a great lead into my next question around data. What are some of the key reasons why people don't believe the data? And what are some of the metrics that are challenging to try and enforce?
I think when we look at what do we measure, I think having a common definition of whatever the measurement is. So if the definition is block utilization, you know, what does that mean? So how do we measure, you know, a surgical block? Is it from the time the patient rolls in the room to the time the patient rolls out? You know, we talk about turnover, and a lot of people focus on surgical turnover time. You know, is there a common definition for that? And what's the amount of time? If you look at turnover time, a lot of people talk about 30 minutes. Well, 30 minutes between two cataracts cases is way too long. 30 minutes between two open heart cases may not be long enough. Then the other piece is, how long is it from the time the patient comes in the room before the surgeon can start surgery? And so we always have those debates. Or how long is it from the time the surgeon puts in the last stitch to the patient's out of the room? So one of the things that I think is critical is that we define each of those times and then establish a benchmark. And so we can use a national benchmark, or we can establish the times and then collect our own data and then agree upon a benchmark for that data at our facility. If you have multiple facilities, now you even have more data, then you can establish those benchmarks for a system. And once those benchmarks are established, then you can define block utilization. And the more that those definitions are transparent, they're, you know, it's obvious how I collected it, it can be reproduced. The surgeons then, who are individuals with advanced degrees, with a lot of statistics, can look at the data, understand how it was collected, and now they buy in.
You know, when you think about the existence of EHRs, which have been around for a long, long time, you know, since the 70s or at least the 80s and 90s, they have a lot of data about patients and their surgeries and the use of block time. And yet every health system that we work with, and even the ones we don't, struggles with this concept of access, of maximizing use of time. You know, you and I have coined this term, no block left behind, as a way of making sure, right?
Right.
Why is that? Why are traditional tools not good enough?
Sanjeev, as we've talked, the one thing that I would say to my peers, this information and my thinking didn't happen yesterday and without education. And let me digress for a moment. When I was in the military in 1990 at Portsmouth Naval Hospital, I had an exceptional boss, a leader, who was also a mentor of mine. And we attended a course that was put on at the time by DJ Sullivan, that was a perioperative consultant. And it was talking about efficiencies in the operating room. Now, we had an electronic medical record. It was the beginnings of that in the military. The course talked to us about certain time stamps during the procedures that we should collect, and that would lead us to what we just talked about. Mm-hmm. The problem is, when you purchase an electronic health record, it comes with a standard set of processes, a standard template for a perioperative note, regardless of what the EHR is. What it doesn't do, it collects a ton of data, but it doesn't necessarily collect the data and create the reports that we just talked about unless you tell the company what you want. And if you don't know what you want, you just get a whole bunch of data that doesn't make much sense. Mm-hmm. And so what I learned back in the 90s, when I had the opportunity to put in electronic health records in the civilian sector, I took that information from the 90s and said to the Epics, to the Cerners, to the Meditechs, this is what I want to collect from the perioperative data. So we identified timestamps, collected it, and then could turn that raw data into something to make a decision. And what I love so much about, you know, the IQ tool that you at LeanTOS put together is you've done it for us. And it gives us data to make business decisions from. And that's unique that no EHR has provided.
it's a really interesting discussion we also have in the book, Brian, as you know, where we talk about how, you know, it's really nobody's fault. The purpose of certain tools are horizontal tools that serve as transactional platforms for billing, for being the single record for patient encounters, actually do a very good job. So the EHRs actually do a very good job for what they were intended. The issue of deep domain expertise that you pointed out, what do I need in the periop environment that is unique to periop? How do I look at this data and I predict, for example, who's not going to use time? How do I take into account probability theory, or how do I use more sophisticated mathematics to predict and prescribe is indeed the way of the future. And the fact is the data in the EHR is a fantastic sort of platform to do that. Let's move a little bit into the unique challenges of a system as large as Common Spirit. You have at least a couple of EHRs. You have a very widespread footprint. I don't know, is it 20 states or more when you put together Dignity and CHI?
I think so.
So when you're, what are the unique challenges to a system that big? Because it's different from a localized system that might be spread across, say, a state when you're talking about 20 states. What do you have to do that's different?
I think the biggest challenge is to establish that relationship. Regardless of the organization, that personal relationship where you build trust in someone or in a situation, I think is enormously critical. And so to do that, having that interpersonal relationship, I talk about servant leadership a lot, where I'm basically not telling someone what to do. I'm basically showing them that this way is the best way, not only for my hospital or my division, but it's also the best way for the system. Because now if we're all similar to a crew boat, if we're all rowing in the same direction, then we'll get to our destination a lot smoother and faster with a lot of less work. So I'm not expending a lot of energy, not doing something with others. And so my biggest challenge is to get those in Nebraska who don't know me from Adam to say, okay, Brian, that makes sense. And we'll take this journey with you. And then to do the same thing in Texas, the Pacific Northwest, right. Chattanooga, right. Arkansas. It's that interpersonal relationship that's the biggest challenge. It makes it a little bit harder now because I'm not traveling the way I was before Corona. But by the same token, I spend most of my day in a Zoom call working with others one-on-one and then connecting them to other hospitals that have had success that I've worked for in the past. And so I think that's the biggest thing. We all want to feed off of each other's success by using bright spots that we call them that has led to success and then duplicating that in other markets.
You know, and I'm assuming that degree of personal relationship, I can imagine how not being able to be face to face is a big challenge. So let's spend maybe a minute on how sort of the biggest elephant in the room, which is COVID-19, has impacted operations. How have you managed through it, and what are some of the upcoming goals and objectives that you have?
When COVID hit, you know, we experienced what everyone else experienced in the country, and that was we stopped elective surgery. Mm-hmm. So the engine that drives this large locomotive, if you would, of healthcare almost came to a halt, because everything else that we do in healthcare, where we're providing care for those, you know, in need, doesn't necessarily generate revenue. So one of the reasons why, you know, health systems across the country really were hit bad was, yes, we were doing a lot of care, a lot of high complex COVID care, a lot of ICU needs, but we weren't generating the revenue from our procedures to support that. One of the first things we did after all of the needs for COVID were being answered, you know, PPE, ventilators, and so forth, was we immediately started working with the strategy group. And when I say we, I mean the perioperative leaders. And we sat down with the strategy groups and we talked about how do we open our operating rooms as quick as possible once we get direction from CDC and state governments and so forth. Well, as we started to progress and we got information from, you know, the American Hospital Association, the American College of Surgeons, from AORN for perioperative nursing, from CDC, we built a toolkit to reestablish elective surgery based on the states allowing us to move forward. So we were pretty quick out of the gate opening up our operating rooms in the communities that we could, and also understanding that we might fluctuate. We might be able to start, like, as we did, full bore in Texas, and then the numbers in Texas started going up and we curtailed elective surgery again. The nice part about being able to fully operationalize unused surgical time and making it available is allowing us to continue to take advantage of our operating rooms and generate as much contribution as possible. So our goal over the next year, because we think COVID's going to be here with us throughout the next year, is to identify that first come, first serve time and make it available, but also to identify the unused surgical time to get surgeons to release their time at least 7-14 days out so that others can see that it's available and then promote that available time. What sounds crazy, but it's true. The more surgeons who release their unused block, the more time there's available for that exact same surgeon to pick up outside of his or her block. And so over the past several months, we've been meeting with the C-suites of all of the Dignity hospitals that have the tool in it, promoting just how easy it is for a surgeon to release time or to pick up time. We've also, through unbelievable analytics and predictive analytics, have been able to illustrate how far out in advance do the surgeons at our facilities schedule cases. So we've been able to move the auto release time. That's the time that our EHRs will automatically release block that's not being used. We've been able to move that auto release time from an average of about 3 days now out to a minimum of 7 days, because 7 days wow. more is kind of the sweet spot where people can pick up time and coordinate things with patients and get them scheduled. So that's been our goal for the next 12 months, and that is that no unused surgical time goes unavailable.
That's remarkable, Brian. And, you know, obviously, as partners in this journey, this is it's been fascinating to see. And my last couple of questions are really related to this change you've been able to bring about in standardizing definitions, in using math and analytics to make decisions. And I'll be honest with you, you know, the larger an institution is, the harder it is, we have felt from our end, to turn the ship, because there's so right. many different constituents and so many different historical practices. There's, in fact, a chapter in the book, you'll get a kick out of this, Brian, we say, you know, sacred cows make the best burgers.
Oh, yes.
And if you think about the more successful an institution is, the bigger an institution is, mm-hmm. my personal assumption is there are more sacred cows that create resistance to change. So in wrapping up, I'd love your perspective on why has healthcare lagged other industries that have had similar problems? What have you done that's different to be an early adopter to innovate with companies, not just us, but Dignity right. innovates with many, many forward-looking companies. What is it about the culture? What is it that's allowed you to overcome some of these sacred cows? And what advice would you have to your peers?
I think, medicine is an art, if you've heard. And somewhere in the 70s, 80s, medicine became a business. And if you look at the practice that we learn in a nursing school or that surgeons learn in medical school residency, we don't talk about healthcare business a lot. A lot of those sacred cows are made up of historical practices before the mindset of healthcare as a business took place, like the block time. The surgeons that have been there the longest get the, you know, most prestigious block. A lot of those surgeons who've been there the longest are the ones who don't use their block so well because they're getting up in age. The way we made this change is, one, it starts at the top. So the leadership within Common Spirit believes in innovation. They believe in new cutting edge technology that's going to improve patient care and either, you know, bring greater access to those who need it and greater quality to those who deserve it. And that's all of our patients. What I love about Common Spirit is we're still in the inner cities. We're still in the communities where the hospital is the only health system in the area. And so to do that, to carry on the sisters' mission, we have to use those assets as judiciously as possible. And so that cutting edge computer learning, machine learning information that's now prevalent, we have to take advantage of. And to do that, you know, we have to be change agents. And it goes back to that establishing the relationship. So if I or my peers have to sit down with the chief of surgery at a teaching hospital or the chief of surgery at a community hospital who's been there forever and walk them through the analytics so that they understand it, walk them through why we're collecting the analytics and why them being physician champions will help us not only grow our business, but more importantly, Sanjeev, it'll help us keep the doors open of the facilities in the communities that need it the most. As an example, in Southern California, in Long Beach, there's a community hospital that's in the middle of downtown Long Beach. And when we first started this, we got a lot of pushback from the physicians in the community and the hospital leadership. That hospital has bought in 110%, and they've expanded the OR capability by about 30%. It's amazing.
Wow.
What happened. And just last week, their chief financial officer, after a presentation by your team and I to them on the capabilities of the tool, invited us to a 2-hour strategy session with the C-suite about growing their surgical business. We were only supposed to talk for about 10 minutes, and they kept us on the line for 45 minutes asking us questions. And we used the tool to answer their questions.
Do you think COVID can actually be a catalyst to help us get more efficient?
I think most definitely. I think regardless of what's going to transpire in November with our, you know, presidential election, healthcare is going to change. The dollars that we're spending on healthcare are going to shrink. And so we have to be smart about it. So like I said earlier, let's take advantage of what we're dealing with COVID to create a new partnership between our surgeons and our facilities so that we're seen as a give and take relationship. I am a strong believer in providing block time for surgeons. But I'm also a strong believer in the surgeons being custodians of that block time, positive custodians, to where if they're not going to use it, they need to release it in sufficient time for someone else to use. And doing that with the tools that are now available, why not take advantage of that tool like yours and expand our capabilities and improve access to all? I think that's how we move forward. And that's making sure that all of those in our communities, surgeons, patients alike, have access to operating rooms when they need them to help improve patient care.
Thank you for tuning into the Becker's Healthcare Podcast Series. We want to thank LeanTos, a remarkable company, for sponsoring this episode. You can always listen to more podcasts at the Becker's Healthcare Podcast page or on Becker's Healthcare, wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you.